So, Moody, when did you first come to Middletown?
I came to Middletown in 1929, June of 1929.
What part of the country did you come from?
Originally, I came from Norfolk, Virginia.
What were your reasons for moving here?
Well, I guess I just wanted to get away from where I was at. At the time, things wasn't so hot there. And I met a friend. I was from South Carolina, and he decided he had an offer for a job here in Middletown, and offered to take me and others, you know. So we all decided to come to Middletown.
Mm-hmm. What kind of job was that?
Working in a brickyard. Uh-huh. Tuttle Brick Company of Middletown. Mm-hmm. At that time, the most of the colored was living here worked there. In fact, the only place they worked was that. Well, there's a few worked in construction, one or two, but not much more than that. All most of that in the brickyard.
Mm-hmm. Where did you live when you first arrived to Middletown?
I lived on a brickyard. They had the facilities, the houses for some of the help, you know. And I board and lodged at one of the fellows that had a house on the place, on the premises. Mm-hmm.
Did the housing have enough rooms for, like, your family? Could you bring your family here then?
Well, no, I was just rooming, see. As I was 29, I went back to Norfolk, and my foreman, Mr. George Tullin, he let me know that I could get a job the next year. He liked the way I worked. And if I could arrange it, then I'd bring my family back. I had promised my wife that I would bring her back and my children.
Did you work all year round at the brickyard?
Well, no, it was seasonal, you see. Some of the fellows worked all the time. In fact, I was led to believe that I could be working all the year round, too.
When you weren't working at the brickyard, did you find other jobs? Were there a lot of other jobs for blacks in Middletown?
No, I went home after the season closed, seasonal way. And when the season started opening, I was to come back. But I was during the depression that it crashed, the stock market crashed. Well, Mr. Tullin wrote me that I'd better wait a few days longer, because things didn't look so well at that particular time. In the meantime, I'd left home. I guess I passed the letter while I was coming back up here. And when I got here, it was no work hardly at all. And some of the fellows were working. And since I'd come up here, he made place for me, made the way that I could work just the same. In the meantime, my wife, she didn't like it because I told her how things were and I'd rather come back home. And she thought I was wrong, you know, saying I just didn't want to come no way. So I hung on. And I borrowed money with what I had to help bring my wife and family up here. I had four children at that time, four children. And she came. And the next week after I got up here, I was laid off. Next week, and I went to Mr. Tuttle. I was the old man, Mr. George Tuttle, and told him my predicament. I just got my wife up here, and I didn't have any money and no ways of getting them back. So he made this other woman tell her that laid me off to rehire me and put me back to work again, which I did. And my wife got sick afterwards. And I had it pretty rough there. I mean, finally, I got laid off then because she had a big layoff, massive layoff, and I couldn't avoid, didn't miss that one. And that's when I had to go to the city for help. hole I got on, my wife's cousin had rented a house, three-room house, from Reverend Banks, another colored man. And we stayed together here, me and Foster, that we had two bedrooms and a kitchen, that's all. That's how I made my four kids. And that's how I survived, with the help of the city. They had to give me a slip $3 or $4 a week. And I had to do that quite a while.
What other blacks were here in Middletown when you arrived? Were there many other families?
Well, there wasn't too many colored people here at the time. It was, I'd say about 7-8 colored families, maybe. More or less, I couldn't say definite, but I had time to think I might, some more might come to my mind, remember, but it was where a few most of them was right at the brickyard. And at Reverend Banks, he had the place to have Mrs. Porter's tree, one. There's two ladies there, who elderly women lived by themselves. And another fellow and his wife. That's all I can remember, except the rest was out in the brickyard. Mm-hmm.
Was there a black church here then?
Oh, yes, it was. But the membership consists of people from Portland, Cromwell, and Middletown, and the fellows, and families in the at the brickyard at Newfield. That consists of the whole congregation. And it was really, wasn't too many there. I imagine during that time now, it wasn't only about three cars in the whole city belonged to color, maybe four. And I imagine when the church had its full capacity of it, it'd be about 2 dozen, 3 dozen, or something like that. But remember, they came all the way around. See, it wasn't just in Milltown. But the congregation.
Was that the same for the brickyard? Did blacks from other towns take the bus into Middletown to work at the brickyard?
Oh, yeah, some. They had a shuttle train. Some come from Berlin, East Berlin, and Portland, Cromwell. All over. See, they all came in, all colored.
So there was
We were in the minority at the brickyard, see. Mostly it was white, most Italian people right there. And they were in the majority there. And of course, they were here longer than we were. And imagine, and the supervisory, they were almost so 4 months, you know. Some was 4 months, bosses and all. And Tull Company was quite a large family, and most all the Tulls was 4 months and so on, you know.
So where did you move after you left the housing area around the brickyard?
To my wife's cousin on Bridge Street at Reverend Banks. Mm-hmm. And I stayed there until I got a chance to get a house back at the brickyard. So I had a house there. That's where I moved my family. The rent was cheap, and I had room for costs. In the meantime, my family was growing, see. And I lived at Brickyard for about 15 years I lived at Brickyard. And then I come getting jobs other places because, as I said, it was seasonal work. And during the Depression, there was hardly any work at all there. I make sometime $1.50 a week, $2. We was got under 20 cents an hour. And we have a car to load. Maybe the foreman to pick out four or five fellows to load that, which was about 3 hours. 3 hours away. Then the next group, maybe, and next day they might have another car. And if you got another group next day, you might not have anything in the next 2 days, 3 days. And of course, I still was in the city because I couldn't afford to, my family couldn't exist on what I was getting then. Some weeks, $1.80, $2, 80 cents. My rent was $5 per month. But I never could pay it up. When I'd get all the way behind, just get behind, they wouldn't put me out. But, and the season opened, well, it would take me practically the whole season to catch up at $5 per month. And then the winter, I go right back in debt again. And the city had to supplement that because I just couldn't do any better. And my wife would have children. Well, they'd take care of the city, we'd take care of that. It was just milk. And fuel, oil. Now, a person that had a few children, quite a few children, they got along much better than a man and his wife because, I don't know, the children came for us. Mm-hmm. And that respect, I got along pretty good, see, because, well, we had all together we had 8 children afterwards.
So the amount of relief money you received depended on the number of children that you had.
I imagine what, because I would get a $4 check. That's for relief check to get groceries.
Was this during the Depression?
That was during the Depression. And of course that was plenty. Because 24 and a half pound bag of flour wouldn't cost for 40 cents. You get 4 pounds of hamburger steak, 4 pounds per quarter. Shoulder meat would cost you 8 cents a pound. Ham, smoked ham, would cost you 12 cents a pound. So, and rice would cost you 3 cents a pound. So I lived pretty good in those circumstances. I did. Only one thing, you know, a person has a little pride. I still didn't like the idea. I had to go to them and ask them for what, and they decide, and they want to know my whole history, why I wanted it, why I shouldn't, and all those things. But that was one of the things we had to pay. That's one of the record sites that we did. They would have to inquire, check, I guess, so that it wouldn't be somebody just soldiering on, we'll say.
So it really wasn't easy to get.
Oh, no. No. It wasn't easy. It was not. Now, what you got was, if you didn't get a chance to get a job, you would really take the job. To avoid that economy of this, asking them for this and that, and they decide what you shouldn't have, that's too much, you have to come back later and all that sort of thing.
During the Depression, did the government set up any agencies to give out food to people that...
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. But that city controlled that. The city used that. So, and eventually we got the WPA, CWA and all that sort of stuff. I worked on that. Make my $15... for 4 days, I think, 3 days or 4 days, I'd make $15 a week. And then the next group they have there, 4 days. Now, during the time the city had its program, they would pay us $2 a day, 3 days a week, $6. And then the next group would make the other six, 3 days. Now, if it rained over 2 days, 3 days or whatever, you're out of luck because you couldn't get in there. Well, the city would come in and give you a little slip because you wouldn't have anything else. It could rain my whole 3 days and I would be out my whole pay of $6. And then, of course, the person with the family, as I said, they got the first chance at those days, $2. A day, for 3 days a week. Once the PWA got inaugurated and started, by, it was a little better, much better, $15 a pay. And apparently you felt like you're rich almost, you know, being so long, getting $2 a week, $3 a week, and all that sort of stuff.
You mentioned something about a slip that the city would give you. Was that to buy food, or?
Yes, 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 that's right. We made out to certain stores that you'd get the food. Well, it was a little restriction. They didn't want you buying any cigarettes, certain things like that. But that could always be evaded because the fella knew how you was. He had a pack of cigarettes anyway. He had 2 packs.
So it wasn't the same thing like food stamps?
No, food stamp. They just make out a slip. And they have a duplicate. They put the paper on it and all that. And they have the other part for check, you know, the balance there. But it was, as I said, I didn't have it. I've seen it have been much worse. But luckily, they treated me pretty good, I think, under circumstances. But it wasn't like working and making your own. It was a little restriction on the way you did this, how you did it. Now, during the holidays, like Thanksgiving, Christmas, at various organizations around town, churches, it's except for little family like me, I was assured of getting a turkey, goose, whatever, you know how it is, and all the trimmings that go along with to have this nice thing. And Christmas time, same thing. And they give various parties for children, Christmas party and toys and all that sort of stuff.
This was your job?
Huh?
Your job did this?
No, the city.
Oh, the city.
No, but the man and wife, we didn't have any children. It was a little more difficult for him. He was exempted from those things. So he'd like a turkey and men and all that sort of stuff. But they could go after the government put in that subsidy of that canned beef that you have to give us and eggs and butter, potatoes. Everybody's entitled to get some of that according to the size of the family.
That was free.
That was free. And you go down and check your name and all. And no, anybody just couldn't go in and get it now. It had to be something they had to know who you were and all that sort of stuff. So they always kept a list of the different ones, you know, where
the family said,
that's right, and the others said. And another thing, too, that some fellas would have, did have a car. They couldn't drive it. They had to send them licenses or something, leave it to them. I've heard of one turn over their insurance policies and all that sort of stuff. But I told them I didn't have any. I know. I just kept mine. I didn't have an insurance. I just couldn't see myself doing that. But I've heard about quite a few had to just leave the car there with all that. See, now you can go up and drive right to Social Security and get your check. You can. At this place where I'm eating at, we're making this hot meal, you know, something in this check. People come up to the nice flying cars. The reason I won't drive mine is because it's only a couple of blocks, so I should drive. I seen a lady come up there with a big Grand Prix flying and have a big duffel bag. She's just getting all the extras put in. Oh, you can see so many people just getting away with everything. And I look at her, I wonder. I know people that got 2 and 3 homes. Man and wife. So you can't get away from this graph and all that sort of stuff.
What kind of jobs were created under the WPA? More people could get work then after that program was created?
Well, the WPA was the type of work they was doing. It's just maybe digging ditches, cutting shrubbery, and trees, all that sort of stuff. And there was nothing creative about it, just cleaning up, just making something. That was...
But more people had an opportunity to get one.
Oh, yeah, you could apply for it and then get it. since you didn't have anything else to do. So they'd give you a job. In fact, that took you off the, took the strain off the city itself, see? Because that was a government function, see, the WPE, CWA. And we were glad of it because they gave us a little more money. And I remember, see, sometime where I was living, I had a kerosene lamp. And the kids would sometimes break all their globes, nano globes, and smoke up everything. And that's how it is. One night, I remember, woke up, the wick ran up to something. And all the smoke, sooty, the set ball hanging over everything. And my kids would all smoke sooty. I'm glad we woke up because that was you know, could have been combustible. Mm-hmm. But those things we could be instructing us now. And all in all, though, it had a tendency to bring most of the people together, see, because the whites and the colored, all of us was broke, didn't have nothing. Didn't have anything. And you'd be surprised how nice the whites and the colored got along then. We all in the same boat. But once everything comes getting better, and little things come just going on up and up, well, naturally, the whites went up a little higher, faster than we did. And there comes that little friction, come right back again. The same kind of stuff, just. Mm-hmm. And they come, it's, oh, Jeannie, I am telling the other son, why don't you go back south? Some guy telling me that, we can talk English. Why don't you go back down the south where you come from? And talking to him, he's talking the best English he can. This is a fella, he come up here when you stay home where you belong. And I wonder, where do I belong? See, I'm part Indian, I'm part white, I'm part Negro. Now, where do I belong at? See, my people was here when this country was supposed to be discovered, the Indians. Some of my people were called themselves discovered it. White. Yeah, that's some of my people. Then they went to Africa and brought some of my people, which is me. Now, where am I supposed to go back? That's what I wonder sometimes. Where is he supposed to go back? Where? All those things are just ignorant, you know. I just wonder what kind of answer could I give them? Or why? What kind of answer can they give me? They just shrug it off, you know. You see, we are the largest minority in the United States, the Negroes. But they push the Italian, the French, the German, the Swedish, the Irish, the Danish, the Finnish, all together. White, see? So that makes them, in that context, that's the largest, that's the majority. But if you put them out in the other context, we'd be the largest. But in order to protect themselves, I imagine, if you want to put it that way, they fuse themselves together. Sometime I'm downstairs in the lobby or over there where we're eating at. It's about six or seven of us at a table in a group talking. And there's six or seven nationalities, and only me there, see, and another colored guy. But we the minority because all six or seven of them are white, and they assume themselves. Now, even the Puerto Ricans, they say blacks, whites, and the Puerto Ricans. Now, what color is a Puerto Rican? That's how they do. You notice that contact? They say, I was taught in school, I don't know how you taught, black, white, brown, yellow. Yeah? Black, white, the brown, the yellow. Now the Puerto Rican race, what is that? Huh? No those are things that bugs me. I don't know. Well, I'm too old to learn now, I guess. What they do is this. They keep, they're Puerto Rican, it keeps them from being ours, us. So he thinks he's better than us. But the whites, that puts him below me. So that puts the Puerto Rican in a bad spot, too, because we get along better than the Puerto Ricans. And these Italians up here, you'll never see down the south, Mr. Kozicki or Mr. Jekyllardo, or no senator. They ain't gonna name no kind of name like that from the south. They ain't gonna be no senator.
After your job with the WPA, did you go back to working at the brickyard, or did you find another job?
Oh, yes. I come to Skin Round. I come to getting high society, you would call it. Myself, I like the founders, and the Amola. Meat treat operator, buffer portion. In fact, a lot of the jobs that I didn't know existed. Because when I came here, I could hear some noise at the Wilcox Crittenden. Like, boom, boom, boom. I didn't know what it was. They told me, said that was a hammer, you know, back hammer. That's a hammer. I couldn't understand what kind of hammer it is. So because it's all white right there. Color didn't get a chance to go in and see what things were. But when this World War II came on the scene, and it comes getting short of men, well, your color didn't mean anything. They need a manpower. They need somebody. And the west part of this country was, they were caught short with a lot of fellas where they didn't understand. They didn't give us a privilege on any of those things. Then they had to break us in a crash program, had to break us in on it. And of course, we messed up a whole lot of stuff because we didn't know what started. They would say, oh, that's all right. We all had to learn. And eventually we did learn. I learned to be galvanized, run a kiln, and all that sort of stuff. Something I didn't know nothing about. So since then, until this little recession is coming back, we can work in anything.
So you would say that economic opportunities for blacks have increased substantially?
I can't say substantial. Substantial means pretty good and nice. They have increased, I'd say that way. Because now, there's lots of places here that you have the privilege of going and asking for a job. And they'll take your name and address and we'll let you know and all that sort of stuff. And if you're making out an application form, if you go out the door and remember something else, you should put in the application and come back to tell them that problem's in the wastebasket. And they say, oh, yes? Yes, well, I'll make a note of that because they're afraid to put it, it's in the wastebasket, that same application. It's one thing about the South, job, you expect what they want you to do, you can do it, you can get it. You won't be making no trips there needlessly, because there's some white folks jobs and colored folks jobs, that's how it is. See, in the South, you see a job digging ditches, like working out streets, cleaning streets. Colored man get a job, you know, truck driving, that's our job. But it isn't the case, yeah. You see ditch diggers around here and all this country. All white. Now you might see a colored fellow now and then, too. It's a special school, I guess, what they call it. But on the other hand, it's progression, I'd say that.
What kinds of social activities did family members engage in?
Oh, gee, that's nice. Well, gee, we made all kinds of social activities, see? Well, I'm a musician, and I'm just several of us. And during the Depression, our form of entertainment was we'd go out in the woods and pick grapes, make our own wine, and everybody had a barrel of wine or something. And if you come to my house, two or three of us, I go down cellar and get a half gallon stuff on the table, no complaint. No money involved, because nobody had no money. And then I come to your house, and me and another, we do the same, reciprocate. Now we want to have a party. See, a big thing was jigsaw parties. You might know about jigsaws and all that, so I'm sure you know about jigsaw parties. Cut up the pictures and putting the blocks together, you know, make up the picture. Wow, that was all big thing, have a jigsaw party. Well, those big jigsaw puzzle cost about a quarter, 25 cents. So we put in 3 cents, 4 cents, well, I got 2 cents, the other guy might got 5 cents, and one might have 10 cents.
Yeah, a group of all of us, maybe about 25 or 30 year old.
And that'd be our party, get a big board, table, spread it all up, and everybody started putting pieces together, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we have our wine there, cider, we have some music, because we'd be playing our instrument, dance, and played until about maybe 12, 11, 12, 1 o'clock. Didn't hardly make any difference what time we go home, because there was no work nowhere, you know, nobody had any work to do. And that's our form of enjoyment, entertainment, social activities. Mm-hmm. And besides going to church, we do that too. And of course, the collection was very meager. Going to church, you know, you have 5 cents, maybe 10 cents sometimes put into it. So you never see no dollars and all that sort of stuff. Money was being changed. The Reverend Biddle was the pastor. Yeah, when I came here, oh, that was years ago, he was a Civil War veteran. And of course, he died later. There's two alive at the time I was here. That was Mr. Meach, or Meach and Stoddard, Green, exported white man, and Reverend Biddle, colored minister. And that was our form. We go in swimming too, swimming hole, and see what else we do. Play ball, we got up a team.
The ball team.
Got a ball team, and we throw parties and sell hog head, pig feet, and all that sort of chillings. And make money, and we got the fun and got together and got the whole team equipped with uniforms. So we did pretty nice. As I said before, we were just like the rest of the folks. Nobody else didn't have anything, so we didn't either.
You said you used to make money
Oh, yes, I did. The money was at a minimum there. Dollar, dollar and a quarter, that's what you get. Now, I had quite a few of my boys. It's been big time, even a big time.
What was the name of your band? Did you have a band?
Yeah. Sonny Moody and his Bounds of Rhythm. And quite a few. I belong to this union now. It's local. In fact, the president was asking me yesterday morning, and why didn't I apply for a gold card? Not pay anything else no more because I've been in so long. And I was thinking about doing that because I don't play actually, no, not too much now because I have arthritis and all things, tripped old age. I had my fingers, one of them crushed, and I can't bend it. Good. And I played 3 times last year, that's it, at the union there. Gave me the privilege to play those jobs. It was quite a nice little thing. $50, 2 hours away. And the other two, I got $30 for 2 hours away.
Do you remember if there were any blacks involved in politics?
Politics? Oh, yes. That's, we have now at McRae. He's a councilman here. And we had also Reverend... Reverend, Reverend Davidge. He was chairman of the Human Relations Committee.
Is this a long time ago? I'm talking about like way back in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s.
Oh, no. Well, in the 40s, we had the only thing we had to mind then was we had some police. Two supernumeraries. That was Captain Eddie Jackson. Now he's captain. And this fellow that used to have a clean impression shop on Sumner Street, I can't think of his name. He's working at the over in the college now in one of the buildings. Mm-hmm. At the clean impression shop right across from Frank Marini's. I can't recall his name. Anyway, he was one of the first supernumeraries we had. But he dropped out and Eddie kept continuing on and he kept to be a regular and then he's up now, he's the captain. I guess he'd be retiring soon.
Did any blacks own their own businesses?
Well, that was when I'm trying to call his name now. He had a clean impression shop in William Holloman. He had a clean impression shop in and he was a tailor. And he had a food parlor for him there. My brother-in-law, he's commissioner now. He's he owned Grill. That's my niece's father. And that's...
What was your brother-in-law's name? What is his name?
John Davis. John Davis. And we had quite a few in the later years. We got a few little things, you know, started. And but the only one that's still holding out is my brother-in-law, John Davis. He's the only one I have in mind can think of now that has any business now. I mean, I can't think of anyone. Oh, and we have a barber, Jerome Bird. Yeah. And there's another one, I don't know his name. Then we have Hoga's Restaurant. That's another. He caters to quite a few parties and all. In fact, he has a contract of serving the foods that we eat over the senior citizen there now. My niece's husband is. Oh, he's one of the officials of that. I think he's working the head quite.
How do blacks in Middletown get around? Was there public bus transportation here?
Well, they had public bus transportation. Yeah, they had the buses run out all over. Then they also had a gas car, gas train that ran from Middletown East Berlin. That was like a coach and a train, only it was ran by gas, you know, a gas engine all that. We all had to, facilities for getting around was pretty good. But most of us was used to walking a lot then, see, because we've been poor so long. See, we didn't think of nothing. I remember the incident, me and a fellow went to walk from Milltown to New Haven looking for a job. And got right into New Haven. Just before we got in New Haven, somebody picked us up and gave us a job, or gave us a ride about four blocks where we were going. Needless to say, we didn't get the job, so we had to walk all the way back again. We had better luck coming back. We had a couple of lifts back. We got back the same day. But 2 days, one day going there and one day coming back. But we walked back the whole distance going there.
Can you remember any severe winter storms here?
Oh, yeah.
There was a flood back in 1930.
Oh, 37, 38, yes. I remember. In fact, my oldest son, stuck a nail in his foot. And the only communication we had with Milltown outside was Mr. Ollie Faison. He had a battery-operated radio. Because all the power was out all the way around, the walls and everything else. Well, we were pretty good for water until the flood rose so high that inundated the motor that was at the brickyard, so they couldn't pump no water in it. And it took about 3 hours to get my son to the hospital, just from Newfield. I had to go all the way up, across the hills, all the way up Meriden, all the way around, and boats, and transfer him to get him back to Milltown to give him antitoxin or shots for But the rental was pretty severe back in those times. I don't know what happened now. Things are much different. We don't hardly have any rentals out at all now. Can't get used to them because you might have one day real bad here and then another time. But back in those days, say from end of December and February, you just wouldn't see the ground no more until that's in its entirety to around about maybe April, May, sometime like that. I've seen it snow yet, man, and I've seen it snow yet.
They have snow plows come around and clear the streets for people so people could walk and ride and so forth.
Oh, they had some plows. But mostly we had shovels, see, that's where we make all the big money, us poor people. That's when the city had to hire a bunch of fellows with shovels to shovel out. I've known time I shoveled from Milltown to Maromas all the way around, the bunch of fellows. That's all day. And sometimes it snows high, we didn't have no shorts, had long handles shovels where you could shovel way up, you know, it snowed me so deep. And also, Wilcox Pond, that's right across on Quinn Ward, Maryland, on Harper. That frees over, we walk across over there in that island and cut wood, saw wood, you know. That was some of the WPA's job. And sled the wood back across ice, across to the Connecticut River, back on this side, and give it to poor people, you know, that's the flood. We have the marker right on the bridge going to Harper now. You might have seen it. Marker up there showed you the high water mark of the flood in 37, I think, or 38, because we had one in both years. Yeah, cars. We all in there. You couldn't see no parts of the car. Nothing. And some of the places that you, where the posts were, of course, the electric was all dead. You had to raise the wiping and throw your boat underneath it. Well, some places you go right over the wire. And in Cromwell, we couldn't get there. Just unless by boat. And in Milltown, they had most of the people in the low parts. They lived up in the YMCA and the Armory. That's where they had to stay. The water came up in my house, just about 3-4 feet from our back door before it stopped, you know, and subsided. And we wouldn't sleep nights. Everybody would be watching, you know. We'd keep coming forward. We'd set a deadline. We was going to start getting away from it.
Did the Red Cross come in to help flood victims out?
Yes, they came in, and we all had shots, different various kinds of shots. And the CC boys, CC camps. They'd bring out water. We didn't have no water.
To the people's homes.
That's right. 5 gallons in 5 gallon jugs. And some people, all the furniture was growing. So they brought, gave us furniture.
What was the CCP boys? What was that?
That was a vegan conservation corps. That's something the government had for younger fellows to give them something to do that was 15, 16 years old, you know, 14. They got $30 a month in food. And they were supposed to give some of that to their parents, you know, and they could have some. Well, Tent City, it was a ma'am, I can't remember what name he was. He had that name. And that was one of the times I got me a job in New York working as a janitor. And I left my family here and went to this job. And I can't remember this mayor, but he decided to put all the colored people out. I'm sure you might can get interview somebody to know, you know, just about how it was.
Because you weren't here.
I wasn't here at the time, but I knew about it, and but I can't say with accuracy just how it was. I do know all the boys got together and burned it down. And he lost his electorate the next year, that same year, to put him up. And I'm sure you'll find someone can tell you more definite, accurately about the happenings. It was a marriage that had a thing. Putting the colored people in tents. I know the place where it was at. But I can't say definitely just how it, what happened on. I know some of the fellows involved in burning it down, too, but I won't tell that.
Although there were no black politicians running, did black citizens still go out and vote?
Oh, yes, you could vote, but Reverend Darish, the one we were speaking about, he spearheaded that the fight against that. And of course he won, and he won from there, and from then on he was in politics up to his death when he got sick while he retired. He retired from a job then, politics, and he never recovered from his illness. That's it.
He came out and spoke against Tent City.
Came out and spoke plenty about it, against it. And he won, and a lot of whites right on our side. Because you remember, lots of things that happened to us that was good. We had some good white people there. See, all whites are not bad. We realize that. But some of them, they won't come out outright because they feel they'll lose the other friendships where they are not that so outspoken. But after Reverend Davish, he spoke out against us. He spoke out against the law and the suffering. He ran for several offices after that. And I guess they decided to shut his mouth by giving this other job so he wouldn't have to be. But his job then, and the last job he had was Human Relations Commissioner. And any time any of us people was felt discriminated in a way about housing, whatever, he would come to bat. And most of the time he'd run to. If you have a good case, if you didn't, why, he'd tell you. If that person was in their rights.
Was this during the 1950s or?
No, it was 1967. 1960s. But he started in the 1950s. That's from Reverend Davis, right?
Yeah, but Tent City, when was that, in the 50s?
Tent City was in the 50s. That's in the late 50s, early 60s.
Can you tell me anything about the history of black churches in Middletown?
Well, Sang said something about, now we have two wine over in, you're speaking about in Middletown. Well, EME sign on Cross Street, EME, the Methodist Church. That's one of the oldest churches in the city of Middletown. That was given to the colored, beaded something in the 60s, 1860s or something, maybe earlier.
So that church would be long before.
Long time before me. Long time before in most. Long time before any of the. That's wrong when you're living with nobody. And the church I belong to, Zion Baptist Church, is just recently